5 criminal probe of the Bidens, Bidens plural. Republicans' impeachment probe of President Biden is unraveling because of a lack of evidence, but their work could become the basis for federal investigations and even prosecutions of the Biden family if Trump wins re-election, Axios has learned. A source close to the Trump campaign says everything you have seen from the Biden DOJ, you can expect to see from the Trump DOJ. One Trump ally argued there is precedent for a second Trump administration to investigate and prosecute the Bidens, the current federal charges against Donald Trump. Where do you even start with something like this? Number one, the authoritarian framework of Project 2025 is not only at a general federal level, it is also part of this unflinching desire to get Biden for what Trump claims is Biden sicking the DOJ and I guess the Attorney General of New York and I guess the state of Georgia, right? I mean, you'd have to believe a lot of crazy things, but Trump is alleging Biden is running these investigations and indictments of him. There's no evidence of that. But what does appear to be the case, and Trump has alluded to it, and now Axios is reporting it directly, is that Trump's plan is to weaponize the Trump DOJ against Joe Biden. Now, understand that, again, Biden's been in elected office for decades. They have nothing on him. It has been the sole focus for some Republican members of the House to find the dirt on Biden. And they haven't even found impropriety by Joe Biden, never mind anything approaching criminality. The witch hunt that Trump claimed was against him and was meritless, had merit. The witch hunt against Biden really does appear to be merely a witch hunt, and it has completely fallen through. And it's because the facts and the evidence aren't on the side of those going after Joe Biden. But it's not going to stop them from trying it. Once again, Catherine Stewart told us, Ellie Honig told us, all of these folks have told us, you have to believe these people when they tell you what they're going to do. And they are going to try. It is not going to stop them. And you know what? There's two sides to the James Comer realization that they're not impeaching Biden. Just as a reminder, James Comer has been one of the lead Republicans in the House who has been going on TV and pushing forward this Biden crimes narrative. They're just, all of the blockbuster evidence is just barely out of reach. They're about to get it. And he has now, Comer, has started sending out fundraising emails where he says, listen, the impeachment, it's not going to happen. Part of why it's not going to happen is Democrats control the Senate. They would never vote to convict. But the criminal referrals are why I need you to donate to me. And so they're being very clear. If you zoom out, Trump has alluded to it. Comer has said it. And Axios now has been able to report it. They want to remain in control of the House of Representatives in 2025 going forward. And they want to take control of the Senate in 2025 going forward, with the idea that they are going to be able to completely and totally function as an arm to target Biden and his family. This includes criminal referrals, which hopefully a Trump DOJ will carry forward. Now, as far as bogus investigations go, they arguably made a mistake, and it was a timing mistake. And again, it's all projection. Trump has argued that these indictments came at the time to be most advantageous for Democrats and for Joe Biden. I have argued that that doesn't really make sense. It would have arguably been better if Biden was directing Trump's indictments and they wanted to time it to be as useful to Biden's reelection as possible. They would be doing it later. They would be doing it now. They would be dropping the bombshells over the summer when more voters are paying attention. But again, the idea of timing of this stuff, what Republicans should have done to do more damage to the Biden campaign was launch all of this Biden crime stuff later as well. Republicans seem to have mistakenly started it too early. It's completely petered out like a wet, it's just like a wet noodle. It's collapsed. There's nothing there. Voters are realizing it. So when it comes to timing, Republicans do seem to have made a mistake. So it's a great thing that Axios got the scoop and has published this. At the same time, if you've been paying attention, it's obvious they tried it with the Hillary Clinton email lies and acid washing and bleaching and Swiffering and all of it. The emails, they're going to try it again. What we can hope for is they lose the House and they...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We demand that Google drop Project Nimbus, the $1.2 billion contract between them and Israel. We demand that Google protect their Arab, Muslim, and Palestinian worker voices from harassment, retaliation, suppression. And we demand that Google recognize Project Nimbus as a workplace safety and health concern.
At least 9 Google workers are arrested after sitting in at the company's offices in New York and the Google CEO's office in Sunnyvale, California, to protest the tech giant's work with the Israeli government. We'll speak with 2 of them and an organizer with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. Then 4,000 Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, begin voting to join the United Auto Workers as it tries to expand in the South. We'll speak with labor journalist Hamilton Nolan, author of The Hammer: Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. But first, it's the one-year anniversary of the civil war in Sudan, which has created one of the world's worst humanitarian crises.
This is more than a conflict between two warring parties. It is a war being waged on the Sudanese people. It is a war on the many thousands of civilians who have been killed and tens of thousands maimed for life.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has accused Israel of continuing to unlawfully restrict aid into Gaza, despite acknowledgments by the United States that parts of Gaza are already experiencing famine. Ravina Shamdasani of the UN Human Rights Office spoke in Geneva Tuesday.
Israel continues to impose unlawful restrictions on the entry and distribution of humanitarian assistance, carry out widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure as well.
This comes as the official death toll in Gaza nears 34,000, including over 14,000 children and 10,000 women. A new report by UN Women finds Israel's assault on Gaza has left more than 19,000 children orphaned. Earlier today, Israel struck a playground and busy market in the Maghazi refugee camp. Tension remains high in the Middle East as world leaders urge Israel to show restraint following Iran's recent drone and missile attack. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron has urged Israel to do, quote, as little as possible to escalate tensions with Iran. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has accused Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of provoking Iran by first bombing the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, 2 weeks ago.
Netanyahu is endangering the lives of both his own citizens and all the peoples in the region to extend his political life. This is an indisputable fact. The one responsible for the tension that made our hearts skip a beat on the night of April 13 is Netanyahu and his government, which is seeing red.
The United Nations Human Rights Office is calling on Israel to stop supporting violent Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. In recent days, settlers have killed at least 3 Palestinians and attacked a number of villages, burning dozens of homes to the ground. Human Rights Watch has accused Israeli military forces of either taking part in the attacks or failing to protect Palestinians from the settlers. Meanwhile, The Guardian's revealed Israel's been speeding up plans over the past 6 months to build thousands of housing units in new illegal settlements in East Jerusalem. At least 9 workers at Google were arrested Tuesday after staging sit-ins at the company's offices here in New York City and in Sunnyvale, California, in the CEO's office, to protest Project Nimbus, a $1.2 billion contract to provide cloud computing services to the Israeli government and military. Iman Hasim is a Google software engineer in Sunnyvale.
We demand that Google drop Project Nimbus, the $1.2 billion contract between them and Israel. We demand that Google protect their Arab, Muslim, and Palestinian worker voices from harassment, retaliation, suppression. And we demand that Google recognize Project Nimbus as a workplace safety and health concern.
We'll have more on Google later in the show, with 2 of those Google workers arrested. In other protest news, students at Columbia University and Barnard College have set up dozens of tents on campus to create what they're calling a Gaza solidarity encampment. This is Isra Hirsi, a student at Barnard, who's the daughter of Congressmember Ilhan Omar.
Hello, I am a organizer with TU Apartheid Divest. Today we have over 100-plus people who have come together to form the Gaza Solidarity Encampment. Today we are calling for divestment. We are calling for amnesty for suspended students, as well as transparency from Columbia University on what they invest in.
The president of Columbia University is testifying before Congress today. The first 7 jurors have been selected in Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial. Jury selections expected to continue on Thursday. Opening arguments could begin as soon as Monday. Judge Juan Merchan has admonished the former president for intimidating jurors after Trump was heard muttering something under his breath during jury selection. On Tuesday, Trump reportedly fell asleep during the proceedings for a 2nd day in a row. Trump's charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to hide a $130,000 payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 election. The U.S. Supreme Court's weighing whether the Justice Department has improperly used a federal obstruction law to charge more than 350 people involved in the January 6th insurrection. Several justices appeared skeptical of the DOJ's reasoning during oral arguments Tuesday. This is Justice Clarence Thomas.
There have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings. As the government applied this provision to other protests in the past, and has this been the government's position throughout the lifespan of the statute?
Justice Thomas has refused to recuse himself from cases related to the January 6th insurrection, even though his wife, Ginny Thomas, attended Trump's Stop the Steal rally on the Eclipse just before Trump supporters attacked the Capitol. The Supreme Court's decision could also impact the prosecution of Donald Trump, who faces 4 counts under the law, which was passed after the Enron scandal. The possible extradition of imprisoned WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange to the United States has edged a step closer. On Tuesday, the Biden administration provided assurances to the British High Court that Assange would not face the death penalty and that his First Amendment rights would be protected if he were to be extradited from Britain, where he's been locked up for years. Assange's wife, Stella, slammed the U.S. response, saying, quote, "The diplomatic note does nothing to relieve our family's extreme distress about his future, his grim expectation of spending the rest of his life in isolation in U.S. prison for publishing award-winning journalism," she said. In news from India, security forces have killed 29 Maoist rebels in the central state of Chhattisgarh just days before India's national elections begin. It was one of the deadliest attacks on the Naxalite movement in years. In news from Capitol Hill, Republican Congressmember Thomas Massie of Kentucky has joined Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene's bid to oust Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. Massie made the announcement a day after Johnson unveiled a plan to advance separate bills to send aid to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. Meanwhile, House Republicans have finally sent articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate. In voting news, Maine's become the latest state to join the National Popular Vote Compact, which could transform the way presidents are elected in the United States. 16 states and Washington, D.C. have now pledged to award their combined 209 electoral votes to the presidential candidate who wins the nationwide popular vote. The compact will only go into effect once supporters of the compact control at least 270 votes. Support for the National Popular Vote Compact has grown in recent years after both George W. Bush and Donald Trump were elected president despite losing the popular vote. In California, a former U.S. Marine has been sentenced to 9 years in prison for firebombing a Planned Parenthood clinic in Costa Mesa in 2022. Chance Brannon pleaded guilty in November. He admitted he'd also planned to attack a second Planned Parenthood clinic and an LGBTQ pride celebration at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. Two other people involved have also pleaded guilty and will be sentenced in May. In a major win for LGBTQ rights advocates, a federal appeals court has blocked West Virginia's measure banning transgender children and youth from participating in public school and college sports. The ruling stemmed from a case involving 13-year-old Becky Pepper Jackson, a trans athlete who's been challenging West Virginia's ban since 2021. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court is allowing Idaho to enforce its ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth while lawsuits over the measure are heard in lower courts. Under the law, physicians in Idaho face up to 10 years in prison for providing hormones, puberty blockers, or other gender-affirming care to trans children under the age of 18. And here in New York, two police officers involved in the fatal shooting of Kowalski Trawick in 2019 will not face internal discipline. New York's police commissioner, Edward Caban, said officers Brendan Thompson and Herbert Davis, quote, acted within the law when they entered Trawick's Bronx apartment and Officer Thompson, who's white, shot him 4 times. Trawick, who was 32, an aspiring dancer, had a history of mental illness and was living in special housing when he called 911. The two officers found him holding a knife as he repeatedly told them he was cooking and asked why the officers were inside his home. The full incident lasted less than 2 minutes. The officers did not face criminal charges. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
1 year ago this week, a devastating civil war erupted in Sudan when a fragile alliance between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, collapsed, pitting the two sides against each other. The war initially began around the capital city of Khartoum, but quickly spread to other parts of Sudan, including Darfur, Port Sudan, and Gezira State, situated in the country's agricultural heartland. 1 year on, the conflict has created what the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has called, quote, one of the worst displacement and humanitarian crises in the world, and one of the most neglected and ignored. More than 8.6 million people have been driven from their homes, creating the world's largest displacement crisis. A new report by the International Organization for Migration has found 20,000 people are forced to flee their homes in Sudan every day, half of them children. The crisis has been compounded by food insecurity, with the World Food Program recently warning Sudan's facing the world's largest hunger crisis. The number of Sudanese facing emergency levels of hunger, one stage before famine, has more than tripled in a year to almost 5 million, according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, a UN-backed index. Save the Children has warned that 230,000 children, pregnant women, and newborn mothers could die of malnutrition in the coming months. Meanwhile, Sudan's health system has collapsed, allowing outbreaks of diseases, including measles and cholera. The war erupted April 15, 2023, when a planned political transition following the ouster and a popular uprising of President Omar al-Bashir after 30 years in power fell apart between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces. For more, we're joined by Khaled Mustafa Medeni, an associate professor of political science and Islamic studies at McGill University, chair of the African Studies program there. His recent piece for Merup is headlined The Struggle for Sudan, a Primer. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you here in studio in New York, Professor. If you can start off by telling us where Sudan stands 1 year after the war erupted.
Well, first of all, thank you, Amy, for having me on the show. It's a real honor. Thank you for your coverage of Sudan. I think that where we stand is an unbelievable kind of what the Doctors Without Borders have called a failure of humanity. I think that there are very few crises in the world historically, including in Africa, where there's been such an acceleration in just 1 year of the kind of devastation that you just itemized. 9 million displaced internally, over 1 million across the borders, the 7 borders of Sudan, mostly in Chad, Egypt, and South Sudan, and the complete destruction of the infrastructure. In addition to that, in December of last year, something occurred that has accelerated the famine, basically, not just food insecurity, but the expansion of the famine, and that is the attack on the Jazeera state in central Sudan, which really produces over 60% of the agricultural products of the country. In addition to that, of course, there are 70% of the hospitals that are destroyed. The educational system has completely collapsed. And so the acceleration of this kind of devastation, I don't think we've seen since perhaps maybe the genocide in Rwanda. And I think that compounding that for those of us, of course, concerned about the situation is the lack of attention to the conflict. Of course, eyes are elsewhere, but that has been a really problematic aspect of this conflict so far.
And Professor, you remarked that this is a war that doesn't have a support for either side among the Sudanese people. Could you talk about that and also the roots of this conflict going back to the revolution of 2017 and 2018, how that informed these current warring parties?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the very kind of unique aspects of this particular war, and local Sudanese have insisted, including in Darfur, one of the most ravaged regions, that this is not a civil war, that this is essentially a war between two generals. On the one side, Abdel Fattah Burhan, who's the head of Sudan Armed Forces. On the other side, the militia leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti. And whereas, in general, civil wars are characterized by, two groups with some kind of significant constituency in civil society supporting one side or the other. In this particular case, the war has absolutely no legitimacy in civil society and no real constituency for either side. And that, I think, is unique in the history of conflicts in Africa and, I would argue, elsewhere. The reason for that has very much to do with what you said, and that is the genesis and the root of the war really is the revolution of 2018-2019 that many people followed throughout the world. And what was unique about that particular pro-democracy revolution is that it encompassed the entire country. It wasn't just in the urban areas. It wasn't just in the rural areas. It wasn't just middle-class Sudanese, but Sudanese across social classes, Sudanese across regions, across ethnicities, rose up in late 2018 as a result of implementation of economic policies that raised the price of consumer goods. And it expanded over a 6 month period, leading, as you probably know, to the downfall and the ouster of an authoritarian regime led by Omar Bashir that lasted for 30 years and had conducted or executed 3 different wars in the country. That is really the genesis for viewers and listeners to understand, because this war is essentially a war against that revolution. It's a war against the Sudanese people. Both of these generals, while they have a great deal of competition over resources, over political power, have one thing in common, and that is their fear of this kind of revolutionary potential and their essentially fear of Sudanese civil society. That's why, in addition to all of the kind of devastation that we've been talking about, a key aspect of the targeting has been civilians. Civilians, of course, have been the greatest victims, and not just, randomly. I'm talking about not only doctors and journalists, but also activists and those members of what we call in Sudan and are well known to be the grassroots resistance committees that led the revolution. Those people are either being targeted and killed or expelled from the country or forced to leave the country. And so that becomes a really important aspect of the root of this particular kind of conflict in Sudan.
And could you talk also about the influence of outside governments on the conflict and in preventing a ceasefire, especially Egypt and the United Arab Emirates, and where is the African Union on this?
Well, it's very important to understand that the external forces had very much to do with supporting what was a fragile coalition between civilian leaders and military leaders. At that time, there was an alliance between these two warring generals, which I think that it's very important to understand. Because of the continued protest for democracy in Sudan, by the end of 2022, there was something called a framework agreement, basically talks to bring together civilian leaders and these generals in order to oversee a transition to democracy. That was overseen by the international community, in particular the United States, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, the EU. And the genesis of the external involvement and the failure to see Sudan through peace and a democratic transition really has to be understood in that context. It was at that point that I would argue that the failure of achieving a civilian transition occurred, and it was, of course, a result of the machinations of these two generals, but also the lack of foresight with respect to external actors at the time, specifically the lack of inclusion of the very forces and groups and youth and resistance committees and civil society organizations that really were the ones who mobilized for the revolution. So that is really important. That failure of the framework agreement, it was accelerated, it was not inclusive, and of course, as you know, the catalyst for this war began in the context of a contentious issue around merging the militias into the standing army. That, of course, would have led to the lack of autonomy and power of the militia leader who has gone to war against the Sudan Armed Forces. And at the same time, of course, the Sudan Armed Forces, Burhan at its head, was very concerned about having two command and control institutions. In essence, he wanted to control the country. So to answer your question currently about external actors, that is the genesis of their lack of foresight in terms of really supporting the revolution, in my view. To bring it up to date, the kind of variety of interest, Egypt's interest in and support of the Sudan Armed Forces, the United Arab Emirates' support of the militia, and Saudi Arabia's support also of the Sudan Armed Forces, has led to this situation where we have up to three or four different peace initiatives, one in Saudi Arabia, headed by the U.S., one in Djibouti, headed by IGAD, the regional bloc, another headed by the UAE that was recently held in Bahrain. Basically, competing peace initiatives that have obstructed, number one, a resolution to the conflict in terms of implementing a ceasefire, but also motivated these two generals because basically they're utilizing their patrons, whether it outside forces, in order to perpetuate the war against the Sudanese people. So I hope that makes sense, but we do have to get back and understand the initial failures of the international community in really implementing a peace agreement that would really satisfy the roots of the problems in Sudan, but most specifically those forces, including resistance committees, young people, civil society organizations that mobilized for the revolution. The reason I mentioned that is that any resolution to this conflict would require getting back to that, an understanding, given that this is a war against the civilian population, the support must be given to the civilian population and immediately be included in any peace initiative that would seek to resolve this conflict.
Professor, on Monday, the French President, Emmanuel Macron, announced that donors had pledged more than $2 billion to Sudan. He was speaking at an international conference in Paris aimed at increasing humanitarian aid to Sudan.
Even if today there are far too many conflicts, and they are conflicts that are covered more by the press and diplomatic efforts, our duty was to make it clear that we are not forgetting what is happening in Sudan, that we remain mobilized, that there are no double standards. We can announce that more than 2 billion euros will be mobilized for the women and men of Sudan. Before this conference, we had a commitment of 190 million euros. This evening, we are at 2 billion euros for Sudan.
So that's French President Emmanuel Macron at this international conference in Paris. If you can talk also about the role of France, but overall, what the international community can do to be most supportive to ending this war.
Well, of course, it's good news. The priority, of course, is to address the humanitarian crisis. There is absolutely no question about that. The 2 billion euros, important. There have been a lot of different initiatives on the part of the United Nations. Very few have met the targets. And this is one of the reasons Doctors Without Borders has called it a failure of humanity, because of the lack of donor, pledges and support. The 2 billion euros are important, but it's very important to understand that one of the central aspects of this conflict is the way that these two parties are using food delivery and aid delivery as a weapon of war, not only in terms of targeting aid workers, but also, you know, setting up bureaucratic blockages, refusing permits for aid workers. And the reason I mentioned that is that $2 billion is extremely important. But the problem is that without a really vigorous political intervention, without understanding that this aid must be really kind of implemented or utilized in the context simultaneously with a vigorous political intervention that seeks to stop the war. And the reason I say that is that one of the most important problematics at the moment, as I mentioned, is the lack of coherent coordination on the part of external actors, with France and the EU, of course, pledging this money, Canada and the United States utilizing sanctions against these two generals, but a lack of coordination that would, A, include civil society organizations to set the agenda for a ceasefire and to implement that kind of ceasefire. And also, this kind of pledge, while it's so important, it really does not make up for the destruction of the distributive networks in Sudan. Aid is an absolutely important aspect, but what is happening now is so severe in terms of food insecurity and the famine that the support of local Sudanese, including organizations that were transformed from resistance communities into voluntary association, like emergency response rooms. So what we need is, a very vigorous political intervention, coordination between the different actors. And I'm talking about the Gulf countries, the United States, Europe, and African countries. All of them have a stake in this conflict. The reason that this pledge has gone through, one of the reasons, is the recognition on the part of external actors, to be quite honest, Amy, that there is not only a huge humanitarian crisis, but the spillover effect across the region, the Red Sea region, the strategic areas that are of such concern to the Gulf countries, to the United States, to Europe, the issue of migration. All of that necessitates a coordinated understanding of the problem or of the intervention, that everyone has a great deal to lose from this conflict. So the pledge is important and very, very important, useful and vital, but without a political coordinated intervention that includes civil society forces and supports local Sudanese organizations like the emergency response rooms, the Darfur Association, and others, we won't really see kind of the restoration of peace.
Professor, I just have one question that maybe you could address briefly. A war of this length obviously requires weapons. Who is supplying the weapons to both sides, and what could be done to put pressure on the arms suppliers of the warring parties?
Well, the problem is that in the Sahel region, in Africa in general, the smuggling of arms is something that is very difficult to control completely. What we call the small arms trade that is really encompasses the entire Sahel region. One of the issues of the arms supplies for the militias has to do previously with the supply of arms that was brought in by United Arab Emirates. That is something that is well known. The Russian Wagner Group also was facilitating arms to the militia. The arms that the Sudan Armed Forces have, of course, number one, has to do with its own stock. It is the Sudan Armed Forces and had received a lot of arms supplies. Recently, as they began to lose the war, particularly in after the fall of Jazeera, the central state, they have been getting arms and drones from Iran as a last resort because of the grave situation they find. So we have Gulf countries involved, Iran involved, the small arms trade. That that requires, of course, great attention. There have been sanctions implemented against the financing of these arms through the corporations of both the militia leaders and the Sudan Armed Forces, who are supported, I want to add, by extremist Islamists as the only small coalition left to support them. So there is a complex of external actors and informal trade of arms. That is important to pay attention to, but without really looking at the ways to implement a ceasefire and restore peace, it's just a stopgap kind of policy or intervention. So it is important, but once again, we have to really bring these regional actors into play. The United States, as you know, has finally appointed a special envoy to Sudan, who has, interestingly enough, reiterated much of what I'm saying, and that is that there needs to be a coordination among the regional actors, the ending of arms supplies by certain actors to the different warring parties. And interestingly enough, he has also emphasized the importance of taking civil society seriously. And I would like to also mention that, and this is very key, that he has also mentioned, as the majority of Sudanese have mentioned, despite the severity of this conflict, there is only one solution and only one interest on the part of the majority of Sudanese, 99% of Sudanese, and that is the restoration of full civilian democracy. I know it's counterintuitive. It seems difficult at this stage to think a post-war in Sudan, but there is, I think, that even if the American envoy has recognized, as I've said in this program a couple of times, that because of the lack of constituency, the lack of legitimacy, the kind of venal, kind of instrumental, self-interested political and economic objectives of these two warring parties, there is absolutely no other way to resolve this conflict except to support the vast majority of the civilian population and Sudanese inside and outside, and to continue what we call the objectives of what Sudanese call al-Thawr al-Majid, the glorious revolution. That is really the only solution, and this is what even the U.S. envoy has reiterated, and I would argue primarily because he's been talking to Sudanese.
Khalid Mustafa Madani, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of Political Science and Islamic Studies at McGill University, also Chair of the African Studies Program. He is from Sudan. We will link to your piece in Merit, headlined The Struggle for Sudan. When we come back, at least 9 Google workers are arrested after staging sit-ins at the company's offices in New York and the Google Cloud CEO's office in Sunnyvale, California, to protest the tech giant's work with the Israeli government. We'll speak with 2 of the arrested workers. Stay with us.
Me.
messenger by Russia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Several Google employees, at least nine, were arrested Tuesday evening after staging sit-ins at the company's offices in New York and in California to protest the tech giant's work with the Israeli government. The sit-ins, organized by the activist group No Tech for Apartheid, took place at Google Cloud CEO Thomas Kurian's office in Sunnyvale, California, and the 10th-floor commons of Google's New York office, which is right around the corner from Democracy Now!. Protesters are calling for Google to withdraw from a $1.2 billion contract to provide cloud computing services to the Israeli government, known as Project Nimbus. Last week, Time magazine reported Google's work on the project involves providing direct services to the Israeli military. The sit-ins were accompanied by outdoor protests at the Google offices here in New York and in Sunnyvale, San Francisco, and Seattle, Washington. Workers and outside activists have opposed the contract since it was signed in 2021, but protests have ramped up over the past several months since Israel's latest bombardment of Gaza. No Tech for Apartheid says Google is enabling and profiting from Israel's use of artificial intelligence to develop a kill list to target Palestinians in Gaza for assassination, with little human oversight. The Israeli military is also using Google Photos for facial recognition across Gaza and the West Bank to identify and detain Palestinians en masse. No Tech for Apartheid has published an open letter co-signed by 18 other groups that demands Google and Amazon immediately cancel their work on Project Nimbus. The letters gathered more than 94,000 signatures from the general public. For more, we're joined by two of the arrested Google workers. Rae Westrick is with us. She's a Google worker organizer with No Tech for Apartheid campaign. Among the workers who occupied Google Cloud CEO's Thomas Kurian's office in Sunnyvale, California. She's joining us from Sunnyvale. And here in New York, we're joined by Mohamed Khatami, a Google software engineer who was arrested at the sit-in at Google's office in New York. He's joining us along with Gabriel Schuvener, a former software engineer at Google Research and organizer with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. And before that, he was with Jewish Diaspora and Tech. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Mohamed, let's begin with you. You were just hours ago in the jail in the local police precinct. Talk about why you were willing to get arrested.
Well, rather than, consider the demands that we've been raising for, years now, and, listening to workers and considering the things that we've been raising, Thomas Kurian and Google execs basically chose to arrest workers for speaking out against the use of our technology to power the first AI-powered genocide. So we were willing to get arrested for that because, at this point, we aren't willing to be lied to by our higher-ups anymore. We aren't willing to be disrespected by our higher-ups anymore. And we wanted to take that to the offices and make sure it was understood by them.
How do you sense is the support that you have among other Google workers, the degree of the dissatisfaction with the policies of Google?
I mean, Google has done a really good job at creating a culture of fear and retaliation against workers in general. But what we noticed was beautiful. So many people came up to our sit-in and basically showed support and felt that they were inspired by the work that we were doing and felt inspired to speak out, which is exactly what we were going for. We want workers to feel like we have the power to choose where our technology is going and who we're contributing to. So I felt really happy to see that.
Rae Westrick, you're on the West Coast. You were arrested in California. Talk about this Project Nimbus and why you were willing to get arrested and what the response. Were you in the offices of the Google Cloud CEO?
Yes. We sat in at the office of Thomas Kurian, the Google Cloud CEO, to protest Project Nimbus, which is a $1.2 billion contract with the Israeli government and military between Google and Amazon. We also were demanding the protection of our coworkers, especially our Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim coworkers, who have been consistently retaliated against, harassed, and doxxed for speaking out about Project Nimbus and, you know, the humanity of Palestinians. So we were there in solidarity with them. We were there to protest the contract, which is being directly sold, providing technology directly to the Israeli military as it inflicts a genocide on Palestinians in Gaza. And yeah, that is why we chose to sit in Thomas Kurian's office.
And Ray, was there any response from the CEO or his office? And are you concerned about losing your job? Why did you decide to take this action?
Yeah. We did not receive any response from the CEO, and I think it's really telling that they would rather let us sit there for over 10 hours and arrest us for peacefully sitting in his office than have leadership engage in our demands in any way at all. So we've received no response from the CEO, and we were forcibly removed by the police. And working at Google has been, you know, an honor. I really love my team. I love the work I do, but I can't in good conscience not do anything while Google is a part of this contract, while Google is selling technology to the Israeli military or any military. And so it was a risk I was willing to take, and I think it's a risk a lot of my coworkers are willing to take because a lot of people are really agitated about this and have consistently made their demands clear and have faced retaliation for it. So I chose to sit in knowing the risks out of care for the use of our technology, out of care for the impact of our technology and care for my coworkers.
For our radio audience, I wanted to let people know that Ray is wearing a T-shirt that says Googler Against Genocide with Genocide and the famous multicolor of Google that it's so well known for. I wanted to bring Gabriel Schubiner into this conversation, a former software engineer at Google Research and organizer with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. And ask you, you know, we had you on more than a year ago. This is before Israel's latest attack on Gaza, talking about exactly this. And you were with the Jewish organization of Google workers at that time speaking out. Talk about the whole history of Project Nimbus.
Yeah.
And the resistance against it.
Yeah, thank you so much. So Project Nimbus was signed in May of 2021. While bombs were being dropped on Gaza, while Palestinians were being evicted from Sheikh Jarrah and beaten at Al-Aqsa Mosque, that was really a point. When we found out about Project Nimbus, personally for me, it was a turning point where I no longer felt able to continue doing my work without engaging and organizing. There was a group of people that felt very similarly, so we started a petition. We were connected, got connected with Amazon workers, with community organizations at Jewish Voice for Peace and Empower Change, and spun a campaign out of that. I want to be clear, like, the campaign really is driven by worker concerns and worker needs around the ethical use of our labor, as well as the direct workplace concerns of the health and safety concerns around working at a company that is facilitating genocide. We've known for a long time that this project was directly targeted at the military. It's been reported in press that Google was giving trainings directly to the IOF. We know that Google gave trainings directly to Mossad. We know that the IOF
When you say IOF, explain the term. Because people are used to hearing IDF, Israeli Defense Forces.
Yeah, it's Israeli Occupation Forces, just to indicate, so we're not repeating their messaging, that their really aggressive repression of Palestinians is an act of defense. We know that it's an act of occupation, so we say IOF. And so we've known for a long time that this project was directly targeted at the Israeli military. But it was only recently through this last contract that Google signed directly with the IOF that we recognized that Google is really doubling down, that this contract is directly intended to facilitate military use. And we know that Google was chosen over other companies because of the advanced AI technology that they are able to offer. So given that we've learned how the IOF is using AI in this war, we really see this as like a really critical campaign for Palestinian liberation. To speak to your point about the resistance against the project, we've been working against this project as workers for since it was signed 3 years ago. We have been doing organizing. We have been doing, you know, base building and labor organizing. We've had protests externally and internally. We've had signed petitions. We've done outreach to our executives through internal forums, through chat rooms, through every available means. Because I think, you know, understanding like this contract really is like it really is an incredible issue for our work. Like all workers labor at Google, so many workers labor is contributing directly to this project because all of the technology at Google is like deeply intertwined with each other. So
I wanted to ask you, the average person who's not a Google worker who might support your stand who uses Google multiple times a day around the world, what are you calling for them to do?
Right. So, I mean, we're calling for everyone around the world to really, like, help us with awareness, like, help us make it known that Google is a war profiteer. I think Google is so deeply embedded in people's lives, right, that it's hard to ask for a boycott. But I think we are calling specifically on people in the tech industry to divest from Google and Amazon. Google Cloud Services and Amazon Web Services underlie the vast majority of the internet. But there are other options. So technology workers actually have a lot of power to shift this paradigm and to like remove technology from this deep complicity with the Israeli occupation.
Mohammed Khatami, can you talk about your own family background and why you so particularly care right now about what's going on in Gaza?
Yeah, yes. So I come from a Muslim family. I was raised Muslim. It's really hard to wake up seeing the images of children slaughtered and know that your, the work you're doing is contributing to this. I've lost sleep. It's just been extremely difficult to focus on work and think that you're working for something that is contributing to the mass slaughter that's taking place. And for speaking out against that, I've literally been called a supporter of terrorism, which is something that
called by,
you know, by coworkers and HR and people in the company, supporter of terrorism, which is, you know, something is it's like a schoolyard insult. It's something I haven't heard since middle school. And that's just an example of the retaliation and the harassment and the hatred that we face just for speaking up against our work being used
in
this way.
Are you concerned about losing your job?
Absolutely. But it's not even important to me at all compared to working for something that is meaningful and having a good impact on the planet. I don't want to have any association with this genocide, and I would hope that Google would change their mind about it as well.
Yeah. And finally, Ray Westrick, where do you see this movement going from here? And can you talk more about the Jewish-Muslim alliance around this among Google workers and former Google workers?
Yeah, I only see this movement growing and continuing to apply pressure. We receive so much support during the sit-in. I've received so many personal messages from people, thanking me for being vocal and asking how they can be more vocal and get more involved. So I think this is absolutely growing. I think Google knows that that this will continue, that, you know, workers are very agitated about this and will continue to speak up and apply pressure. And I think that's why it was important for them to silence us. But this movement is growing, and more people are finding out about this, and more people are willing to organize and risk their jobs in order to take a stand against complicity and genocide.
Well, I want to thank.
And yeah, I think this has been a really unifying campaign for people of all backgrounds, and I know. Specifically, a lot of us came together because we were specifically concerned about how Google has treated and retaliated against our Palestinian Arab and Muslim colleagues, especially like Mohammed mentioned. A lot of them have experienced harassment and doxing for speaking out in like the appropriate channels at Google, and have been consistently ignored and harassed and retaliated against. And so we had to come together to say that we can't let this happen anymore. We have to come together in protection of our coworkers and each other, and in protection of, you know, the ethical use of our technology to make sure that we're not building technology that's being used for harm. So I think it's been a really unifying campaign that is really grounded in taking care of each other and really grounded in making a positive impact and not facilitating more harm with technology.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Ray Westrick and Mohammed Khatami are both Google workers who were arrested yesterday. Ray in the offices of the Google Cloud CEO in Sunnyvale, California, and Mohammed here in New York. Also, Gabriel Schubiner, former software engineer at Google Research and an organizer with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign, before that with Jewish Diaspora in Tech. Next up, 4,000 Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, begin voting on whether to join the United Auto Workers as it tries to expand in the South. Stay with us. You see the tyrants buckle when the lies start to crumble, the high turn humble when the empire tumble, the bone chilling condition, war criminal villain, the pronouns are pronounced as chosen and victim, the bombs in the billions to rain on the children, the holy land built on mass graves you're filling, the poets in the city. It's got stories in their spirit. Owners in the business oppose it when they fear it. But the trees don't forget it. The breeze blow the message. The rivers and seas hold the image. The tears on our cheeks and the beards hold the sweetest little dream. Yeah, Philistine, repeat it in our dreams. When the time turns timeless, the meek finally speak. Oppressors beg the fire to cease. The hearts go blind and so the eyes go to sleep. And who peeping? The ruins that you're seeing. That's you in that museum. Can you feel it? Everyone kept dancing while it was all collapsing. The morning lights were flashing. The Collapse by the Muslim American rapper Brother Ali and Unjust, a Jewish beatmaker and animator from Ohio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today, in a closely watched election, 4,000 Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, start to vote on whether to organize with the United Auto Workers. This could be the UAW's first big victory as they try to expand into the southern United States after huge contract wins last year with the Detroit companies General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis. Pro-union Volkswagen workers in Tennessee spoke in a video produced by A More Perfect Union.
Our health care costs went up almost 15%. Well, they gave us a small 11% increase after the big three negotiated their contract. Well, our insurance costs went up, so it ate up, so we don't see any of that.
Well, if we're going to work for a company like this and they're going to generate that kind of money, then why can't we have our fair share as well?
Volkswagen sales have shot out the roof. $78 billion profit over the past 3 years.
We were able to grow revenues and underlying operating results in a difficult economic environment.
We're the largest automaker in the world, but yet the employees are here struggling.
The loudest voices of the anti-union, they keep trying to press this notion that if we unionize, Volkswagen's going to shut us down. They're going to close their factory. They're not going to pull it out just because 4,000 employees out of 600,000 want to be organized. Not to mention the fact that all of their other factories are organized.
For more, we're joined by Hamilton Nolan, journalist who writes about labor and politics for In These Times, and his Substack, How Things Work, where his latest piece is Trampoline Unionism: Power Expands, It Doesn't Contract. His new book is The Hammer: Power Inequality and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. Hamilton, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about this epic struggle in Tennessee right now, the significance of the workers trying to unionize the Volkswagen plant.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This election is a big, big deal, probably the most important union election that this country has seen in years. It's been decades since UAW or anyone has successfully unionized a big auto plant like this down south. And you know, it's important to understand that these companies are in the South in the first place because they think they can go there to escape unions, to escape regulation, to find more easily exploited workers. It's essentially a form of domestic offshoring. Companies use the South the same way they use Mexico. And so the UAW, which is coming off a big, big win in a national strike last year, has taken that energy that they had from the strike and funneled it directly into a big ambitious plan to organize not just one company down south, but all of the non-union auto companies down south. And this Volkswagen election is the first one to come up for a vote. So this is really going to be an extremely important indicator as to whether the UAW can finally crack these non-union auto plants down south. And if they're able to successfully pull off this Volkswagen election, and I think that, you know, all the reporting on the ground indicates that, you know, cautious optimism is probably warranted here. If they're able to win in Chattanooga, it sends a really powerful signal to all the other non-union auto workers down south that this is not a dream, that this is not something they have to be afraid of, that this is something that can actually be done. And I think you could really see this looking back as the first domino in something that changes the entire South.
And Hamilton, this plant is the only Volkswagen factory in the world without a union. How does the company, how did the company respond to the unionization effort and justify to its workers that this is the only plant that's not that it's not organized?
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. You know, particularly the European automakers are very used to working with unions all over the world, and the plants that they have down south are in many cases the only places where they don't have unions. And still, I think, you know, Volkswagen has claimed to be neutral in this election. I think the workers would tell you they probably haven't quite been neutral, but it really does go to illustrate how ridiculous the South's kind of model of economic development is, which is, for many generations, the South has put forward a theory, you know, that the way to do economic development is just to give companies everything they want, to create easily exploited and economically desperate workforce, and that is the thing that will attract businesses. And, you know, we saw six Southern governors come out with a joint statement yesterday warning workers not to join the UAW. And it was probably one of the most pathetic things I think we can ever see in our life. Governors of U.S. states catering to international corporations before the workers who are citizens of their own states. So again, you know, the South is really funneling money to international corporations for free, and the UAW is trying to put an end to that.
Well, and as you say, there's not only labor organizing spreading across the South, but there's also major gains that have occurred in California that you've written about, the $20 minimum wage for fast food workers there. Can you talk about the importance of that?
Yeah, California recently passed the $20 minimum wage for fast food workers. You know, A, it's obviously something that's good for fast food workers. But B, the interesting thing about that was it's sort of a step down the road towards sectoral bargaining, which means, you know, the ability to negotiate wages and working conditions for entire industries at once, not having to go store to store to store, unionizing every store in order to get a contract at each fast food outlet, which is nearly impossible and is why the fast food industry doesn't have any unions. You know, California establishing things like a wage board that can set a wage for a whole industry, it's a really interesting kind of step towards thinking bigger about ways to empower workers on an industry-wide level. It's something that a lot of people think is really the path for reaching workers on the scale that we need to reestablish union power in America, given how bad our labor laws are and how hard it is to organize at scale. And so it's encouraging, and it's also, I think, an illustration of what you're seeing all over the country, which is red states are running in a real negative direction on labor rights, and blue states, in response, are trying to become more and more progressive on labor rights. And I think that's a trend that's going to continue for a while.
We just have 15 seconds, Hamilton, but I want to ask you about Sean Fain, the head of UAW, being the guest of the Bidens at a White House dinner, and the UAW's stance calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Do you think Sean Fain is getting through to President Biden?
I don't know if he's getting through to President Biden. I haven't seen a lot of evidence based on what Biden has done that Sean Fain has got through to him on that point. Biden's done a lot of nice things for the UAW. But as you said, the UAW and many, many other unions representing at this point the majority of union members in America have called for a ceasefire in Gaza. And that is one issue that Biden is really not being responsive to the labor movement on. So I hope that changes.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Hamilton Nolan, labor journalist. His new book out is called The Hammer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!